we want to answer your questions directly. So as you're hearing things that you want more information on, take your notepad out and just write them. That's not to say that we'll have all the answers, but that's kind of the format we want, not just to talk at you for the full period of time, but to give you a sense of what AP12 is clear on, what will be more of a product of the regulation and work through process. But for it to be as relevant as possible, I said, write down those questions. So again, my name is Amy Rumley from the John Burton Foundation, and I'm very, very happy to be joined today by Jack Kaiser of the California Alliance for Child and Family Services and Jennifer Rodriguez of the Youth Law Center. Both of these organizations, together with the John Burton Foundation and six other organizations, were co-sponsors of AB12. And both of these organizations work collaboratively with us and the other co-sponsors on the AB12 primer. So we're going to start off today with, this is a brief outline of what we're going to be covering. I do want to just say a word that today's, this is all being recorded. It'll all be available, and all of the presentations are going to be available on our website probably within a week and a half to two. We've tried to go green with our institute and not give every organization every presentation. I know that's kind of annoying to some people because some people like riding along with it, but we kind of tried to err on the more environmentally friendly side. But if you do want a version of it, you can download it from the TFP Plus website. So we're going to go through the extension to age 21 provision. You'll notice we're not going to talk about the kid gap conversion provision. That's interesting and important information, but it's not the topic of today's workshop. And then we're going to talk about as much THP Plus specific information as we've got. So let me kick it off by handing it over to Jackie.
Thank you, Amy. So, probably most of you are aware that the bill takes effect, not this next year, but January 25. And the first year, of course, it takes effect from Children's Trial 19 in 2012 and 2013 to 20. And then in 2014, upon the approval of the legislature and the governor's signature, it would go to age 21. All youth in foster care starting in 2012, so it does not cover any youth that are in foster care that are aging out this next year. But all youth that are aging out or emancipating in foster care in 2012 may decide to opt in and to, well, automatically opt in, but they can, you know, remain opted in, not opt out of foster care until, again, age 20, until registered age 21. The youth is all kids that are in foster care, including probation foster care youth, and it's estimated that's probably in the neighborhood every year about 5,000. Or so, about 4,500 to 5,000 youth fit this statistic. It also, the bill is very clear, and the federal government also recognized that we didn't want to have any youth not enter into permanency. So any youth that is entering the kid gap at 16 or older, or is entered into adoption at 16 or older, also will receive, or the parents will receive the kid gap, or will receive the AAP until they're age 21. It does not mean that the youth has to live between ages of 18 and 21 with the adoptive parent or with the guardianship. It just means that that adoptive parent or guardian has responsibility for that youth and obviously will use that money towards the benefit of the youth. So again, you know, the reason for that is to make sure that as many as possible enter into permanency. Because as Amy said earlier, if you just extend foster care and you don't focus on permanency, even between the ages of 18 and 20, 21, you are extenuating years, but you're not necessarily helping the youth at, you know, at a very young age still have a sense of the most success that they can have. So I know as we move forward in regulations that permanency and how to make that part of AB12 will also be part of all of our work groups. The other component is any youth that is in a non-relative dependent placement will also have extension until age 21. And I'm going to keep saying age 21, although I already explained that that's not automatic till 21 goes to 20, but it's just easier to just say age 21. So that means that any youth that's in a non-relative guardianship, and I'm really not sure how technical I want to get, but of course you have a relative guardianship thing gap, and that has to be age 16, but at any age, if a youth is placed in a non-relative guardianship, it can be age 2, it can be, you know, age 5, they will have the ability to have funding or benefits extended until age 21, and that includes Medi-Cal and other supportive services.
For some reason, we are sharing a curtain. Our only wall here is a curtain. So they've asked us, we want
just
you all
to... Just turn it down a little bit so
they... Thank you.
So we should be able to...
So now I'm going to go on to the federal eligibility requirements. These are strictly from the federal bill. So the AB12, the state bill, did not veer off and create so far, you know, our own eligibility requirements. So you've got 5, and the youth has to meet at least one of these in order to participate. And these are pretty broad. We're hoping that really any youth that decides they want to stay in foster care or receive extended care will be able to, based on these 5. The first one is, you know, they're completing high school or they're completing a GED. So they're completing the secondary. The second one is they're enrolled in an institution which provides, you know, post-secondary, you know, college, junior college, et cetera, or vocational training. And as far as I know, at this point, because there have been regulations, I don't know, and I don't know if Jennifer or Amy want to jump in here, but if there's a prescribed amount of hours that they have to be participating in the post-secondary. No. So that'll be worked out in regulations. So again, it didn't say a full-time student or a half-time student, they're just participating in that. The third one is participating in a program or activity designed to promote or remove barriers to employment. Those programs, you know, again, those are going to be worked out in regulation. Many of you that provide T2B Plus, ILP services, you probably have programs that are very akin to that. I know almost all T2B Plus programs have, you know, internship training and job training. And, you know, this is how you dress for an interview. This is how you arrive for work. And this is, you know, the things that you should know, et cetera. So that is the area that will be discussed in regulation as to what exactly that type of organization that can provide that type of removal of barriers to employment is. And we're hoping many of you will provide that. The other one is that you have to be employed for at least 80 hours per month. I'm just gonna throw a little wrench in there saying, I don't know what happens if they're only working 50 hours a month, you know? So we're gonna talk about that too. And the other one is you can't do any of those top 4. You can't do any of the 4 due to a medical condition, and the word medical condition and what that means has not been created, has not been defined. So I'm just gonna say it could be mental medical condition, could be physical medical condition, developmentally disabled. That's again something that will be worked out in the next few months. In terms of how many youth will be likely to participate, we looked at data from Illinois and New York because they already have, their states already have allowed youth to stay in care until age 21 without federal funding. The federal bill now will match any state that allows funding to go to 21, but Illinois and New York have been doing this already. Now, of course, California's been doing this for T2B Plus to age 24, but that has been a very program that I believe that most has been able to allow 25% of youth to enter only because of funding, not because of the number of youth that want to go in, as you know from the waiting list. So if you just look at the chart or the graph, we estimate that in the first year, you know, there are many youth that are not going to go in because they're in the military, they choose not to opt in, their social security, their SSI benefits are higher and they choose to use those benefits even though they would still be allowed to use the social worker benefits of the foster care system. So we're estimating that it would be 61% of all youth that would choose to enter in that first year. Again, many youth are going to want to stay in placement wherever that placement is. You know, they graduate from high school, they get their GED, they go 18 and a half, it's June. Thankfully, they're not going to have to leave or make any sudden movements. They may just remain in care for several months or you know, however long it takes for them to figure out what the next step is. So that's 61%, by the way, it's based on a best guess, but we'll know next year. And the funding is not related to that. There's not a cap. It's not, oh my gosh, it's above 61 and therefore we don't go above. It could be 100%. The next year, the drop usually is half, and it goes to about 38%, because as the youth get older, many of them decide that they can do it without services or without support, although there's a re-entry, and if they do that, you know, kind of trial independence, they can come back in. By age 21, it goes down to 31%, and we used it, I think we're much closer to the New York numbers based upon the population, and I don't know if there's any other reason that we use New York. We're now at placement options. Technically, the placement option is whatever the youth is in at the point that they turn 18 or, you know, emancipate, or if they're 18 and a half, they're still in school, et cetera, up to 19. They can stay there, or they can move out. Or they can stay there for 3 months and then decide to move from foster family home placement to a supervised independent living placement. Or they can immediately decide to move into a supervised independent living placement, decide that's not working, and then ask, you know, maybe to move in with a roommate, a TPP plus foster care. Or they can then go back to their foster parents. So there's no restrictions on the type of placement, except for group home. You cannot stay in the group home placement if you can meet any of the four criteria that I mentioned, and that is if you can work, if you can go to school, if you can be finishing post-secondary education, if you're finishing a high school education or getting a GED, you cannot stay in your group home placement. That was, you know, kind of a funding decision, and as we move into the regulations, we will work on, well, what is a good transition? And it may be a Teach Me Plus Foster Care, it may be a Teach My P. And again, we'll hopefully try to figure out in the next 9 months what makes the most sense for a lot of these youth. You can also live with a non-relative, extended family member. You can obviously can get AAP. You can live with any family member. Quite frankly, it would be approved by, you know, those team decisions, and that would be part of, like, supervised independent living. If you want to have a roommate and it's a family member who's not going to get involved with that. So I think that concludes my part of the discussion, so I'm going to pass it over to Jennifer Rodriguez.
And thanks, everyone. So, Amy already introduced me, but I'm Jennifer Rodriguez from the Staff Attorney at Youth Law Center, and I cannot help myself. So before I start the first slide, I just want to co-sign what Amy said this morning about how appreciative, as a co-sponsor, I am of the work that you all did on getting this to the reality so that we can actually be talking about the details to you all. In 1998, I actually joined the California Youth Connection as a youth member, and this was one of the very first policy issues that the youth identified as really wanting to see in place. And at the time, saying that we wanted youth to be able to stay in foster care until 21 was looked at as absolutely ridiculous. There was no such thing as transitional housing plus in place. People were thinking that even having youth in foster care until the age of 18 was fairly generous. And so really, over the years, hearing from so many youth that there'd just be so much progress made if we were only able to have a few more years to be able to provide youth with that solid foundation, has really, really moved me to thinking, you know, that this is one of the most significant things I think that's happened to improve the lives of young people in foster care in a really long time. And I know my own experience definitely supports, you know, at 18 I was in a high-level group home and I was counting down the days to get out of care. And when I turned 18, I was out thinking I was completely done with the system and I was immediately homeless. And within 4 months I was back in a program looking desperately for programming, ended up being lucky enough to get into Job Corps, which was essentially more foster care, I mean with a different name, a residential program where there were still rules on my life. But for that reason, knowing that Job Corps and having that opportunity was really the reason I was able to get a foundation and go on and become productive and be able to make a change in the system. I'm also particularly grateful that we had the chance to structure this program in the way that we did so that we actually give youth the options. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the practice details of what extended foster care will look like. And so first let's talk about court supervision and how court supervision for youth over the age of 18 will look different than court supervision for minors. So there are some differences that are actually strong legal differences that we've written out in statute and that just exist because we're talking now about legal adults. And there are also some differences that I'm going to highlight that I think actually probably also apply to youth under 18 as well in a best practice world, but that we've made explicit in our drafting of AB 12. And so I'll clarify as we go along which ones are which. So the very first thing here, this is a new change. So now for non-minors who stay in foster care past 18, they are full legal adults and they have rights as full legal adults. What this means is they have the right to consent to their own medical treatment. They have the right to make decisions related to their education. They have the right to enter into contracts on their own, which changes the relationship of the court and the child welfare system to that young person. And it's a relationship that I think should already have started to change probably in the years leading up to 18, but at this point it will have to change because the young person is able to go out and make legal decisions on their own. The court will not be able to dictate. Pre-18, I still hear stories about courts ordering youth to get their hair cut or not cut in a particular way, or denying the ability for youth to go and get tattoos and piercings in particular places. No more of that post-18. We now have full legal adults who are able to make all of the same decisions that any other legal adult would be able to make. So here, on the second change here, I want to say that this is, I'm going to flag this for you as one of the ones that I think is not so clear that it's not true for youth under 18. However, it is absolutely true for youth over 18. So we'll have attorneys who will be acting really in a traditional attorney-client relationship where the youth is their client and the client will direct what the attorney does, so on behalf of that young adult, rather than in the best interest of the minor. So if you go across the state and you talk to attorneys who represent kids in foster care right now, you'll hear that some attorneys already do this. Many attorneys take their responsibility as representing children in foster care to be a traditional attorney-client relationship, and they say, I'm going to go in and whatever my client asks for, I'm going to talk through what the implications are, but I'm going to go in and advocate for that in court. Other attorneys are way at the other end of the extreme, where they sort of see their role more like a social worker. And so in California, our official practice model is actually a client-directed practice model, but the attorneys are sort of all over the place and whether or not their practice aligns with that. Now we have some clear guidelines, and the Judicial Council is going to be developing their own set of forms and regulations and trainings to go along with this. And so this is really going to be a significant shift that actually I hope will help us all get more on the same page, even for the youth under 18. The third change is a definite new change that only applies to youth over the 18, and that's that parents are no longer legal parties to what happens to these youth because now they are legal adults. And so that means that parents don't necessarily have a legal right. They don't have a legal right to know. There may be good reasons for including parents and getting information or having parents at the hearing. But that will sort of be up to the court and the youth to make that happen. So parents will not get notice about the hearing, and they will not be parties to anything that happens. And that helps us flow into the next one, which is absolutely a significant change for youth over the age of 18, that reunification, guardianship, and termination of parental rights, they're no longer case handles. And I want to just stop and pause for a moment and say that the reason that they're not case plan goals is not because the need for permanency is not equal or more important for youth post-18. It's because these are three specific goals that just no longer make sense for youth past 18 in the way that our child welfare system is constructed. So I don't want anyone, nobody, in fact, I feel like I should go stand at the door and check you all as you leave. I don't want anyone to leave this room thinking that permanency is not an appropriate goal for youth post-18. It's just that we are now going to actually have to move into thinking what are new ways that we can achieve those permanent connections for youth post-18 that do not involve things like talking about parental rights, which no longer exist after a young person is 18, or reunification back to legal parents. We may in fact be talking about practical reunification back, about getting the youth back into the family of their birth home and providing services so that that can be a family unit. However, it just won't have the same name and it won't have the same legal constructs to it as it did previously. The last piece here, which is another one of those ones I want to flag for you that I think are actually consistent with goals for transition age youth under the age of 18, but is absolutely true for youth post 18, is that incremental responsibility, meaning giving youth the opportunity to take a step out, make some mistakes, have a safety net under them, learn and get increasing responsibility, and getting the opportunity to live in the least restrictive placement possible are both absolutely goals. They're goals that are specified out in the youth transitional independent living plan. They're goals that the court will be checking on. And so this is another area. It's particularly critical, just like Jackie said, we do not want the period of 18 to 21 to be a time period where we see more business as usual, where we just have foster care extended for 3 more years, because then guess what? What it means is that we're going to have youth at 21 experiencing the same sort of challenges that youth at 18 experience now. But what we really do want to see is that this good practice, which is great practice for youth under 18, where we're really thinking about what is the setting that we can place the youth in that will allow them to practice the most adult living sort of transitional responsibilities possible. How can we get them there? That we're really going to hold to that. And now we'll have the court also involved in that, the youth also involved in evaluating that and signing off on that is my goal as well. So how is court supervision for non-minors the same? As, well, I already pointed out some ways that in a perfect world it would be the same, but here's like just the clear guidelines for you. One, the youth is still a dependent of the juvenile court. Despite the fact that they're now a legal adult and that they may be living in a different type of setting, they are still a dependent of the juvenile court. The juvenile court has oversight over their case. And then secondly, there will be either a court hearing or, if your county elects, an administrative review that occurs every 6 months routinely, where several things will be looked at. One thing that will be looked at in that court hearing or administrative review is whether or not that youth continues to meet the conditions for eligibility. So one of those 5 conditions that Jackie laid out earlier. The second thing that will be looked at, which I actually think is directly connected to the first thing, is whether the social worker or probation officer is continuing to assist the youth in maintaining eligibility or meeting one of those 5 conditions. So what will happen in that court hearing is it will not be a question of, is this youth still in college? Oh no, they're not, then get out. It will instead be, hopefully, with all of your help, the conversation will go much more like, is the youth still in college? Nope. Okay, social worker, probation officer, what are you doing? What are the barriers? And what are you doing to help the youth overcome that barrier? If the issue is that we have a parenting, non-minor parenting young mom, what is the social worker or probation officer doing to help identify childcare, help provide transportation? So really be much more a conversation about how can we align the services that are being provided to the youth with them being able to maintain eligibility. Our goal is to keep youth in care, to help them meet eligibility at all times. Jackie brought up the scenario in this economy, how can we get youth to the required amount of hours? Well, there's lots of ways that we can combine categories. So if we're having a youth who, as we know the data says, many of our youth are underemployed, we can be saying, social worker, probation officer, are you having the youth go out and get employment applications? Are you signing them up for a soft skill job program to add to that amount of hours? So there's lots of creative ways to deal with things. Thirdly, looking at progress, meeting the goals of the Transitional Independent Living Plan. And then lastly, the court will be asking questions about what efforts are being made to keep the youth connected or find connections to permanent, supportive, caring, committed individuals. So we talked about court supervision and how it's different for non-minors. So let's talk about child welfare supervision for non-minor dependents. So how is it different? So one significant difference that's very exciting is that the foster care rate can get paid either completely or in part directly to youth who are capable of signing what's called a mutual agreement. And what this means is for youth who are in what we're calling supervised independent living placements, which are still going to be defined, but basically you should think of these as sort of the new creative placements. Could be a college dorm, could be living with a roommate, could be sort of like a host family transitional housing model. Some setting where they're living more independently under supervision, they can receive their entire payment directly. But youth is in another type of setting, like a group home setting, a THP plus setting, a relative foster home. They may not be receiving the whole payment directly, however, they can enter into a mutual agreement to get part of that payment from the provider so that they can start practicing that incremental responsibility that we talked about earlier. Another way that it's different is that I already talked about one of the two new placement options, the supervised independent living setting. Amy is going to talk in much more detail about the second new placement option, the transitional housing program plus foster care. Another way that it's different is that the youth will be signing the case plan, they'll be signing a mutual agreement. So they'll have to be sitting at the table and agreeing to whatever the case plan is, whatever the placement. And again, this is another one of those ones I want to flag that I think is good practice for youth under 18, that you have the youth actively engaged in this way, but it's clear. For youth post 18, this is what we have to do. And then lastly, the case plan is going to be focused on transitional skills and permanent connections and the development of incremental responsibility. Again, good practice for youth under 18, absolutely required for youth post 18. So how is child welfare supervision for non-minor dependents the same? So one way it's the same is that non-minor dependents will still be eligible for specialized care increment rates, with the exception of supervised independent living settings. So youth that elect to live in a supervised independent living settings will get the age-appropriate basic foster care rate, which I think right now is about $620, $629. So if you're in a supervised independent living setting, you wouldn't be getting the incremental rate, but every other type of setting that you will still be eligible. Social worker contact will still be occurring monthly on average. So we will not, even for youth who are in sort of the most independent living, the independent settings, we will not have be placing them and then not seeing them again for a year. Social workers will continue, and probation officers as well, will be continuing to provide the case management needed to make sure that we are really setting youth up with all of the resources and case management and support necessary to be successful. And there are a number of interesting ways that that might happen in transitional housing plus programs. And then lastly, the TILP will be updated every 6 months, just like happens now. So here's, we'll quickly move through the special topics so we can get to Amy, who actually I think has all of the information that you are probably here to hear. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here because there's a lot of different special populations. So the first thing I just want to say is for you who are discharged but want to return, we anticipate that this might be a common scenario with many youth who are sort of fed up, who want to try that incremental responsibility, they want to try life on their own, and then we'll have extended foster care available for them as a safety net. And the way practically that this will happen is that when youth are exiting foster care, if they say, I want to leave, or if the court finds that they're not currently eligible or they don't have an approved setting to live in, then the court will place them on what's being called a trial independence. And that trial independence will ideally be set to go up to the day before their 21st birthday. And that will allow them to petition any court and any county to re-enter foster care at any time up to their 21st birthday. And I'm saying up to the 21st birthday because I'm an optimist and I believe if we got this incredible statute in place, we're absolutely going to be able to get 20 to 21, no problem, right? Especially with all of your advocacy here in the room, I have no doubt. I'm putting my money on you all. So that will be in place. So youth will be able to go into any court in any county where they're at and petition the court, although responsibility for letting them into court and providing services will still remain in the county that originally had jurisdiction over their case. So this is another area that the courts will be working out, sort of how to make that as seamless and quick as possible. If a youth petitions to re-enter care in Alameda County, but they are originally from Los Angeles County, that will be allowable, and the courts will figure that out.
Second special population of youth are youth who receive regional center services. Basically, this is a category of youth that I will say it the same system continues for youth post 18 as prior to 18. If they are dual consumers of the child welfare system and regional centers, they will continue to receive that regional center rate and the supplemental rate as well. Youth that are likely eligible for or receiving SSI. So I'm just going to say, we could do a whole workshop on exactly how this works for this population of youth. But what I will say is that if youth who are receiving SSI want to continue to stay in extended foster care, they can. Whether their payment comes from SSI or comes from foster care will depend on a whole lot of factors, on which payment is greater, on what setting they're choosing to live in, what the costs of that setting are. But basically, getting SSI is no prohibition, and in fact, we should be even making additional efforts to make sure that all eligible youth that we're applying for SSI on their behalf, that we're making sure that we're monitoring their payments so that they're not getting any overpayments in this very, confusing time where payments may be going this way or that way. And we're going to have to be particularly careful with youth who are getting SSI to make sure that we maintain their eligibility through this period. And again, I'm not going to go into detail on how we can do that because I think it's a whole workshop in itself. But I would just encourage you all to get more information about that. Next category of youth, parenting youth. So parenting youth who are custodial parents have all the same rights to participate in extended foster care as other youth. One important thing for you to note about this population is that the infant supplement will still be available to youth post 18 to the caregiver for taking care of that baby. And if youth are in a supervised independent living setting, they can also receive that infant supplement directly. And every other provision that's currently in place for parenting youth, like if a youth is living in a whole family home and there's a shared responsibility plan, that additional $200 will still be available to caregivers. So lots of resources to help parenting youth access, which is really important because we know this is a particularly vulnerable population that's really going to need assistance. Youth that are exiting juvenile probation. Again, I think this is another topic probably worthy of a whole workshop, so I'm gonna go quickly just sort of through the basics of what you need to know. There are two tracks, essentially, for youth who are exiting juvenile probation to be able to take advantage of extended foster care. The first track is that youth who are under the supervision of the delinquency court can remain under the supervision of the delinquency court and access extended care just as youth who are under the supervision of the dependency court can. Meaning that they would stay in care post 18, continue to have their case monitored by the delinquency court, and would have all of the same rights, options, responsibilities available as other youth who are dependents. As you can imagine, this is probably not the most attractive option for many youth because there's a certain amount of stigma attached to continuing to be a ward, continuing to have the delinquency court involved in your life. So we have created an additional option as well. At the hearing that is closest to either when a youth is about to turn 18 or at any hearing where there is a decision being made to terminate delinquency jurisdiction, the court is required to look at that youth case and ask, one, are they at a point where they no longer need delinquency supervision? Two, are they in a situation where they cannot be returned back to their home of origin safely? And are they in continued sort of at risk of abuse or neglect if they were to be returned? If the answers to those questions are the right ones, yes, they are now in a position where they no longer need delinquency court supervision and know they cannot be returned home safely, as we know is the case for many young people, particularly those young people who are our crossover young people who were in foster care at one point, then moved into a juvenile detention facility, then the court can transfer them over to dependency. And so this is a really, really important opportunity to get that relatively small, but I think super significant and very, very vulnerable population of young people who may have been dropped by the foster care system at some point and moved into the juvenile delinquency system, the opportunity to actually get these benefits and to take advantage. Next category of youth who are on runaway status at the age of 18. These youth will actually, the court will put them on a trial discharge just like all other youth, and so they will be able to petition to re-enter foster care If at some point, and we imagine for many of these youth who are on runaway status, there may be a point in time where they need services, and they may not be coming back to the door of the child welfare system. So it's all the more reason that those of you who are so in touch with your community providers, with legal aid organizations, who might actually encounter these young people, either while they're applying for public benefits or some other sort of services, are aware of how to get those youth access to re-enter into foster care. Undocumented youth. So this is a group of youth who would not be federally eligible for services, but that's okay, because under AB 12, we've created a state extended foster care program as well. And so these youth, I think the basic thing to tell you is that undocumented youth will qualify for the state AB 12 extended foster care program, which entitles them to all of the same resources as other youth, with a small exception if they are placed in the home of a relative caregiver. And again, this is a detail that you can learn more about at a later time, but that's what's good to know. The other thing I want to say that's really important about this population is that this gives us a really important window of time for those youth that we're applying for special immigrant juvenile status to get a little bit more time to process their application and to make sure that we, you know, so I hear so right now so many youth who their immigration status gets flagged at 17 and a half when they go to apply for their first job, and there's simply 6 months is not enough time with the clock ticking to process an SIJS application. And in many counties, there are advocates currently fighting to try to extend the amount of time that the court will keep them in foster care, because the Department of Homeland Security will allow that application to continue to be processed while the youth is still in care. This gives us a great opportunity. I mean, if we can just now work on identifying these youth, we're almost guaranteed that they'll have the window of time necessary to actually get a decision made on their application. So really exciting for this population as well. The only other two populations that I want to flag for you, you might have a couple in mind, are that two populations of youth who will not be eligible for extended foster care are youth who choose to join the military. And so I think this is really important, because I'm hoping that folks are having conversations with young people leaving foster care right now about what the implications of joining the military are, related to other things like financial aid or, you know, just generally. But this is a particularly important benefit that they will be choosing to not be eligible for should they choose to join the military. And I think that's interesting, because probably the reason that many youth choose to join the military is actually to take advantage of AB 12-like services, to get a place to live, to get some job training, to get the opportunity to go to college. So it's a good conversation to have. And then the second category of youth who there's not so much counseling that we can probably do with is youth who choose to get married at the age of 18. So we're hoping that the reason that they are not eligible for AB 12 is because they've gotten married and they're going to ride off happily in the future in the Cinderella pumpkin horse. And so that's all I'm going to say about that for the moment. But I would just encourage you, if there are, in everything that I just said, lots of details important. And so one of the ways that you can be really helpful to us as co-sponsor groups is if you just came up with a million questions as I tried to answer some of the questions that you might have, write down those questions, provide them to us, and we will be making your primer and your questions and answers longer and longer and longer so we can give you all the information you want.
Great. Thank you very much, Jennifer. All right, so now we're going to get into a little bit more about how AB 12 affects THP Plus in its four main areas, and these are the areas that Michelle highlighted. Again, this information is in the THP Plus, THP Plus Foster Care Frequently Asked Questions, along with a lot more information. So in a nutshell, AB 12 specifies 70% of the current THP Plus goes to THP Plus Foster Care, and 30% goes to THP Plus. So we have a $35.8 million budget. So the simple math splits them out between the two areas. It does allow for the reallocation between those programs if there's not sufficient demand for either program. So the first thing I'm going to say, and this is covered in that FAQ, the Frequently Asked Questions, is it's not too soon for you as providers and counties to start a conversation to think about how your county may be dividing these resources. It's very challenging. You don't have an allocation. So how in the heck are you supposed to do that? But nonetheless, the reason why we've been able to make the gains we've been able to make is because you know who each other are, you're already having the conversations. And what I would say about that is to reflect back to the slide that Jackie presented. The uptake rate will be lower than you think it will be. The 60% New York uptake rate is after almost 20 years of implementation. In conversation with those public administrators, their number one feedback is, when we started this, no young people wanted it. So if we have a 30% uptake rate the first year, I will personally be. So this is going to be dynamic. This is going to require more conversations than you previously had amongst yourselves. And, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a guessing game, frankly. And so the stronger your relationships are, the stronger your collaboration is as providers and between and with the county, it's going to serve you very well. So even if you don't feel ready to step out and kind of thinking about that estimating, do think about how you're going to work together. How does this reallocation process happen collaboratively? So what does that mean? I want to give you two different scenarios. So here's a scenario where the current THP Plus budget is maximally leveraged. We take that $35.8 million and the full 70% statewide goes to THP Plus foster care and the balance goes to the current THP Plus program. Based on that, you can see what an estimated federal match is. And of course, not all young people are federally eligible. So I used the rate of federal eligibility based on what was used in all the cost models for the AB 12 cost estimates. So we turned that $25 million into $42 million. That's the beauty of the federal leverage. You know, we talk about what's the leverage? Basically, they give us half the cost. You can see from the THP Plus current program, there's no federal match. Those are 100% state general funds. They're for non-dependents, and they're for young people 21 plus. So you can kind of see how we've taken a program that was $35 million, 35.8, and magically transformed it into a program that has a budget of $53 million. And so again, this is assuming that young people want to be in THP Plus foster care. And that is a very big assumption. But this is a scenario where the funding would be maximally leveraged. So you can see we go from about 1,400 young people, or almost 1,500 young people would be served in THP Plus foster care. 373 would be served in the current program for a total of 1,852 young people. So what we have now is at any moment in time, the 2,245 young people who are served over the course of 12 months, that includes all turnover in the program. The snapshot, the moment in time number of young people that are in THP Plus is more around 1,400. So this would allow our state program to go from about 1,400 young people to about 1,850 young people without any new monies. So again, that's the beauty, that's the magic of the federal leverage. But again, we don't know young people are going to want to be in this placement. So here's another scenario. I think a more likely scenario. We do not fully leverage this money, and we have a lower level of foster care, of THP Plus foster care utilization. This is where we have about 588. This one we worked backwards. We have about 588 young people who want to be in extended care. And you can see what that does. Instead of turning $35.8 million into $53 million, because we have a lower level of participation in THP Plus foster care, we have a lower level of federal leverage, and we serve fewer young people. So again, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you exactly how many young people are going to say, hey, THP Plus foster care sounds pretty good. I think I'll try it. I think we are in much better position than if we were a state who just said, oh, we're going to do this out of the gate. You all have relationships with young people. You have a presence in the community. And that is going to make it more and more appealing to young people. So that's an asset we have. The downside is the perception of court jurisdiction and the perception of child welfare oversight. If those are actually administered in an onerous way, and if they don't make a difference, a positive difference in the lives of young people, they simply will exit. And I can't really say enough about how fundamentally different this is than foster care. Those of you who are THP Plus providers, you know, if a young person doesn't want to be there, they just walk, they just leave. That is so different than foster care for a minor. Foster care for a minor, if you leave, you could get arrested and put into juvenile probation. Like, you don't have the right to exit. I think the strength of our program in California is that we have a whole network of counties and providers who understand and appreciate and respect the fact these young people do not have to be there, and if we don't provide them with services and programs that are appealing, they simply won't. So these are two different scenarios. I personally think the second scenario is a little bit more likely until we can understand how juvenile court supervision and child welfare supervision are going to influence THP Plus. And that's really to be determined. We know technically what it is. Jennifer did a great job providing an overview. And yet, how is it going to play out in practice? Is court engagement going to be a meaningful experience for a young person or not? So the county planning process, this is the second area where there's a major change. So it requires assurances that 30% of the placements will be set aside for the THP Plus population. That's the non-dependent population. It requires how the county will obviously provide for the THP Plus foster care population, and a contingency about how that shift is going to happen if there's not sufficient demand in either program. So traditionally, and this is in the primer, our LOI on a county basis has been due to the state on the February 1st of every year. Now, we don't have any specific direction from CDS about when that county plan is going to be due. To me, it's in all of our interest to begin that thinking and talking. They may not even issue an ACL saying when it's due until February 1st. Who knows? But that doesn't mean that we cannot begin to start and think about that process. And the reason why you want to start is because fiscal year 11-12 will be the first year where extended care is implemented. So the 11-12 fiscal year, the second 6 months of that fiscal year, will include extended care. So just in case it wasn't complicated enough, we split it over a fiscal year for you. So the first half of the fiscal year will not include extended care, and the second will. So these are things, you know, they're all eminently surmountable. But coming together, you know, having people think about this, and really just as a provider's point of view, getting as informed as you can to try and make a strategic assessment about, is this something I want to do or not? The time is now. And there are 9 AB12 sponsors, organizational sponsors. You know, we're just more than all willing to, more than meet you halfway to help you think through that process and provide any technical assistance we can. We can't, you know, there are some things we simply can't do. I mean, there's going to be a date that's determined, and that will be communicated. But there are things that we can do up until that to help promote the thinking and encourage the process to move forward. The next area is the rate structure. So to give you a little backstory here, THP Plus foster care is perceived as a high cost placement. You've got your basic rate, you have your foster family home. Relative to the other placements, it is a higher cost placement. And so the reason why there was a provision to put the THP Plus foster care rate to change it is because the way it's structured right now in statute allows for a very high rate. And you guys have heard us talk about this many times. It's a very high rate that is very rarely utilized. The difference between the maximum rate that is allowable under statute for THP Plus and the actual rate in practice is about a factor of 2. The average rate statewide is $2,400 per youth per month. And so there was a concern that if we don't kind of close that gap and create a little bit more rational basis for the THP Plus rate, that the program cost is going to explode. And so we really need to think about, there are other placements that just have a flat rate, and there's something very simple about a flat rate. But a flat rate doesn't offer as much flexibility and accommodation of individual needs. There's a lot of things that we want to think about when we talk about this new rate. and there's the practice issues, and then there's the kind of political strategery issues, you know, that we want to factor in too, about where are we better off in terms of our rate. But right now, there is not a very good rationale for a high variability of rate, and that makes it a politically sensitive issue. So last, it's just very important to provide input. Again, DSS, there are like 7 or 8 specific things that AB 12 requires CDSS to answer through a work group process. And we are very much advocating for that process to start sooner rather than later. Because January 1st, 2012, when AB 12 was introduced, I was just like, that's forever. We're not gonna make a difference for a million years. January 1st, 2012 is not that far away. And this rate needs to be established by January 1st, 2011. Sorry about that. And so we want to see that process kicked off. And we don't want it, if we want it to be a robust one that includes input and where we test out these different points of view, we need to get the ball rolling. And so, there are a lot of outstanding questions. And the first one is AB 12 currently states 70%. It doesn't say up to 70%. And so that's a little problem. It should have said up to 70%. It was basically an error. And so we're going to be doing cleanup legislation to make sure that word up gets in. The idea behind AB 12 was never to basically rob 70% of THP Plus's budget. And until the worst case scenario, and I'm just going to share it with you because that's kind of the way I think, is that 70% would get put towards THP Plus. Not that many kids want it, and God forbid we underspend. It's not a scenario that's impossible to imagine. So we want to get that word up in there as soon as possible so that we give counties and providers the flexibility of saying this much towards THP Plus foster care, this much towards THP Plus, and we will respond to the needs of our community because we are the people in the community we know best. When is the 11-12 county plan due? We do not know this, and we need to know this soon. If we're going to do thoughtful, robust planning, we need to know it so that you can begin to kind of understand how you're going to put that plan together. We also need to know what specifically is going to be required in that plan. The John Burton Foundation is going to work very actively to advance what it thinks should be in the plan, and the CWDA THP Plus Committee will have a point of view of what should be in the plan. But it needs to go through their formal public process, and they need to come out with some type of guidance so that we can all have a shared understanding of what is in that plan and so that we can produce that. So the current funding, is it a floor or is it a ceiling? It's not 100% clear from the reading of the language whether the $35.8 million is a floor or a ceiling. And that's kind of a big question. The idea was to leverage the current investment. And so let's take up to 70% and leverage that with new federal money. But does that mean that that's all we get? That is a very ambiguous part of AB 12. And again, we're being really candid here. It's in all of our interest to be thinking about these questions and asking them. We'd like to see it as a floor, certainly not a ceiling, because we know $35 million, even if it's fully leveraged, ain't going to get the job done. How can we increase funding for older youth, ineligible youth, and youth who don't want to participate? That scenario, too, was serving a little tiny 300 young people in that category. What are we going to do? How are we going to work together to make sure those young people are served? And how can juvenile court jurisdiction and child welfare supervision contribute, can strengthen our programs? We don't want it to be like checking the boxes. Okay, we want to get the federal money, so we'll do the child welfare supervision, we'll do the court stuff. There's a real potential here for those additional functions to add. Don't laugh, Josh. No, it maybe could sound comical, but I truly believe if we work together, there's a way that they could actually contribute to the strength of our programs and not just be obligatory things we have to do to get the federal funding. That's going to take a lot of creative thinking on all of our parts, but I think we can do it. So from here, we didn't quite live up to our promise of doing this really quickly. We're just getting in the groove of doing these kind of presentations, but I want to take at least 10 minutes and kick off, and let's get as many questions as we can in. We're going to give you the information as kind of succinctly as possible, and I'll kick it off with the question that I had while Jennifer was presenting, which is, what happens if a youth won't sign the case plan? Since they're now this legal adult and they have to sign the case plan, Jennifer, what happens?
If the youth won't sign the case plan, it means they are not agreeing to what's in the case plan, and it is time for everybody to sit down and modify that case plan to be something that everyone can live with. The mutual agreement is something that the youth signs that says that they are willing to live in a supervised setting and that they are agreeing to sort of cooperate with child welfare, to be a partner with child welfare in setting goals for their life. So that's sort of, that's one step. And to me, that mutual agreement also means that the child welfare agency is also agreeing, it's a mutual agreement, to do the same. So youth won't sign, it's time to revisit the case plan. We can't force it on them.
Okay, let's start on this side of the room. Do we have questions here? Yeah, that would be great. Any question, like I said, we're amongst friends. Feel free to ask. And we have, you know, these guys are amazing. In our afternoon session, we're going to have a different set of experts to answer them. It's a great way to get it directly from the people who wrote the legislation.
Hi, thank you for having me today. What type of support do we provide to child welfare workers with regards to services and opportunities available to youth who may be extending their care?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What supports are going to be given to child
welfare workers?
I'd say that's kind of too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was going to, I think,
I think it's,
hello? Okay. I think at this point, frankly, we don't know. It's certainly not specified in AB 12. Anything I would say would be speculative. We'd like to see an entire reworking of the training curriculum, and we have conversations with CalSWEC about developing training modules that apply to the experiences of older youth. And I think that those in this room that work with 18 to 21 year olds could contribute to that greatly. Many of your own organizations have gone through that life cycle of what you thought would work, and then in the end, what really works. But there's nothing in AB 12 that specifies, like, the child welfare worker is going to get these three things.
I will add one more thing. I will also just add that, of course, the first year that only goes up to age 19, and since, you know, many of you already have experience in foster care with youth that go up to age 19, there'll be a little bit of a transition in terms of when you go beyond that.
It doesn't feel like this works.
I have a question about, you said at 18 you need to transition out of group homes. There's a whole issue around licensing about adults and kids and foster care. So if you have a home where one of these kids is now 19, 20, and they have younger children in the homes, are the kids that are 18 then going to be treated as a unrelated
adult in that
home,
and
then
have to be fingerprinted like
often adults are in a foster home?
I think
it's more licensing issues
that
are happening as the kids
get
older.
It's a good question.
It's my understanding that when the youth is in the home and hasn't left the home but remains in the home, that youth does not have to be fingerprinted. It's actually the same as it is right now with youth that are in THP plus host families. If they're in the home, that if they switch and they come back in, I believe they have to be fingerprinted like any other adult.
What if that plan fails?
Yeah.
I just asked you that question.
Oh, if the plan, if you mean if they exit the military, and or they're discharged, I think, and it's, I don't think the bill spells it out, but I think when we go through regulations, if a youth is still under the appropriate age of 21, they will still be able to re-enter foster care. We certainly will push for that in the regulations, and I don't see anything in the current statute of the bill that would prohibit that.
Well, I think the thing that could prohibit it is if the judge does not set a period of trial discharge. So when a young person says, this isn't my cup of tea, thank you very much, they're discharged, and there's a 391 emancipation hearing, and then the judge sets a period of trial discharge. If the young person said, I'm going to the military, the judge may not set a period of trial discharge. So this is, you know, kind of, I think that we have to make sure that they do, because we recognize the military cannot work out too. But if it goes the other way and they don't have a back door if they go to the military, that's a very high stakes decision they're making.
So we're going to fix that in the cleanup bill.
So the plans to extend foster care to 21, are there plans to extend the age, the THP plus age as well? For housing?
Well, it is to currently to 24, so but there are no plans to extend it beyond that. But I like your thinking.
When a young person is attending college in California, but outside their county where they were in foster care before, I know this has been a problem for the dependents before, are they going to be able to have permission to get a new child welfare worker so that they will have access to medical, dental, and mental health services as they attend college or the post-secondary training?
Well, AB 12 definitely doesn't fix the out-of-county medical issues. So the problems they have will be the same problems they have. That's the honest truth. But I think, you know, that is a major issue for young people around the state is the out-of-county medical reimbursement issue. Maybe that's too honest.
How would it work if the child is just only probation youth and not parole youth? And how would their case be closed and be able to be hired? Because when the case is not sealed, or they're over the age of 18, I know that that's a difficulty for them to find employment.
So for the probation provisions, they do not need to be a dual status youth for the probation provisions to apply to them. So everything that I said about probation supervised youth applies to youth who are just under the supervision of the delinquency jurisdiction. Your question is about really a practice issue around what we tell young people about what extended delinquency supervision means. And so the question came up earlier about what type of training we're going to be doing on the child welfare system for social workers and for the juvenile court over there. Well, there's a parallel question around what sort of training we're going to be doing for probation officers in the delinquency court so that they understand that this extended foster care was never intended and cannot be used to extend a sentence for a youth who was under the supervision of the delinquency court. Instead, it has the same exact purpose as youth who are under the supervision of the dependency court. It's the opportunity for them to learn incremental responsibility, to get the supports that they need to move to successful adulthood. And that is going to be, quite frankly, a real culture shift for some probation officers and some delinquency court judges. So in terms of employment, the youth is no longer, even though they are under the supervision of the delinquency court, they are no longer effectively on probation or parole in the way that we think about this, you know, previously. So there will be a whole set of training material. There will be work that we need to do with public defenders so that they understand and are able to advise their clients when they're making a decision about whether to stay in foster care or whether to exit, really what the special implications are of that, of this decision for youth under the supervision of the delinquency court. So I guess the main answer is that stay tuned. It's important to be aware there are many additional implications for youth who choose to stay in care under the supervision of the delinquency court, which is why we created that second route. And I think it's really important for everyone to be aware of that second route, which is that youth who are under the supervision of the delinquency court can petition to move over to the dependency court if they no longer need the supervision of the delinquency court and if they're unable to return home. If those conditions are met, there is no reason we should be leaving them to access this benefit under the delinquency system, because you're right, even if there's not practical, logistical sort of barriers to them getting what they need to, there will be stigma attached to this, there will be confusion. I guarantee you we're gonna have at least one situation where some probation officer calls to violate a youth who ran away from their placement who's 20, and there's a discussion about where do we put a 20-year-old who violates? Do they go to juvenile hall? Do they go to county jail? I just want that scenario to happen as infrequently as possible. So let's really push for every single youth who there's a possibility to get them moved over to that dependency route.
I'm gonna take one more question and then we'll probably break.
Okay, I had two questions that you may or may not be able to answer. One was for probation and child welfare, the crossover, will we be using the 1401 process? Would you know, prior to when they're 18, and then is there a different process after when they're adult? And then for visiting youth and having that monthly contact, and they're in college out of state, what are we doing about that? Right now, we can't go out of state and practice social work. We need to do ICPs, and so I'm just wondering if there's any knowledge about that.
So on question one, the answer is yes. What we have done in AB 12 is really strengthen the 241.1 procedure to make sure that it absolutely has to come in front of the court now. So the court is required to ask this question at court hearings. So we've built on that process. We did not build an analogous process for youth post 18, which is part of the reason why I'm saying it's really important that we make sure that youth who are under the supervision of the delinquency court have a push made before they turn 18 years old. Once they're 18, there is no way that we can choose to move them back over to dependency after that point. So that's unfortunate, but it's important to know because we all need to really be vigilant about that group.
And then in terms of the second question around like telephonic or, you know, out of state or whatever, that is not determined yet. That is going to be set forth in regulation. So it's a really good question because we want young people to go to whatever the best school they can get into, and we don't want them to be limited by that. So I just want to take a moment to thank Jennifer and Jackie for joining us today. Thank you very much. And in your folder, there is an evaluation form, and if you would just take a moment to complete it, and would you please stand, and if you'd be by the door and collect those, we would really appreciate it. We want to know kind of where this hit the mark, and we'll just appreciate the most, you know, candid feedback. This is particularly useful because the organizational co-sponsors of AB 12 are going to be launching a implementation project. So we want to know how to target information, what information you're interested in, where we can go farther, and maybe where we went too far. So thanks for any input you can provide. And from here, I believe at this point, lunch is out in the lobby. Interesting. I don't know if that was ever really even on.
It is.
Oh. I feel like it was. You know.
Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
I was going to say, what Amy said is true. I feel like I learned even more.
Yeah. It's like there's so much in it.
I almost feel like at one of our meetings, we should all present to each other.
I know,
or ask questions of each other. We shouldn't even have an agenda. It should just be all one big Q&A.
Because we all kind of think and care about a little bit more about different things.
We also may have different blends.
Yeah. Oh, hello. Hi, how are you?
Exactly.
Hi. Oh, great. Thanks for being here.
I must have missed what you said pointing out about your first bullet point.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to get him on the first
piece. Is it going to change where we're going to have flexibility of center balances as the band changes, you know?
Good to see you.
Well, yeah, there is. There's a potential in the county plan to reallocate. And yet, that's in direct conflict with the fact that it doesn't take up to 70.